Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Which phone is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
That's... Yeah. They have asked for that, really.
You can laugh. It was the World Cup.
I'm a little bit of an idealist, but having said that, I want to be like me.
But you don't know what you're talking about.
What did you know?
I managed to stay alive for 6 days.
I'd say it to your face, and I'll say it to you now.
I'm down Swanfield, and we'll see them, won't we?
What you doing down here, you shawny man?
I believe it was after Jack Grealish's second goal last night that the Sky Sports commentator said, Aston Villa are not just upsetting the apple cart here, they have pushed it over, smashed the smithereens, and scattered everything everywhere. And it was quite hard to disagree with that. It's not a really overexcited commentary if it's commensurate with what was being said.
That's kind of all implied, though, in the phrase upsetting the apple cart. I mean, it's not like the apple cart is upset by some of the things you've said about it. And is, you know, and is complaining to its friends. Like, I mean, it literally means all of those things. That's all packed into the phrase.
But no, if you're upsetting the apple cart, you could just be not going to. You've obviously bumped into it. The apple cart, the apple vendor.
Yeah, like the top 5% has dribbled off the back of the cart.
But there's still plenty of good apples left that could be sold.
To me, upsetting the apple cart means effectively overturning the apple cart and all hell breaking loose, apples wise. That's what it means to me. But I suppose it just shows the different ways, the different things that the same words mean different things to different people, though.
Hello, all you World Service members and Monday Only listeners. You're very welcome to the Second Captain's Football Podcast. I don't think it'll be a short one. I can probably state that from the outset. I mean, Premier League football may be a parody of itself, clinging to its place in a decaying culture, as a certain cogent football writer wrote last week. Maybe Barney Roney, who also writes fluently about the game, is correct when he says all of it is basically the same homogenised, unceasing, geographically non-specific substance. But that was a lot of fun all the same, wasn't it? I mean, watching it, part of me was thinking, is Ken enjoying this madness, or is it just further confirming to him that the Premier League is staggering on its poorly prepared teams delivering shambolic matches?
Well, that's literally what they're doing. You know, it's just like we can't really remember what we're supposed to be doing, but let's just get out there. It's about showing up in this game. You know, it's like they all turned up. It's like no one's really fit. It doesn't matter. If you're fit to play, as long as it's not COVID-19, you know what I mean? Just get out there and see what happens. So, you just had this... I don't really know. It's obviously something really bizarre is going on, and it's hard to isolate what the reason for it is. And the lack of preparation is one thing, but then you think, well, it was kind of... There were signs of this before as well. You know, there were signs of it sort of last... ever since the empty stadium time, this has been kind of a thing that's been happening. I mean, the Bayern-Barcelona game, when I look back on it now, kind of, I'm like, yeah, that was sort of part of this as well, wasn't it? Like, Barcelona conceding 8 goals.
Do you think one of, like, the driving factors of these insane results, the lack of shame, that basically, devoid of crowds, teams, like, certainly care about losing... But like, it's not like this visceral, oh my God, I'm in front of 40,000 people and I'm making a tit of myself. Yeah. I'm making an absolute show of myself here.
Yeah, I think, I honestly do think that must have something to do with it. I mean, like you look at what's going on, obviously yesterday United lose 1-6 to Tottenham. Villa beat Liverpool 7-2. But before that, you know, you had that, like the Chelsea-West Brom game. The West Brom-Chelsea game, rather, was pretty weird. Like, that was 3-0 at halftime and then 3-0 at full-time. The City-Leicester results. Like, City lose 2-5 to Leicester. And then Leicester lose 3-0 at home to West Ham. So, David, Brendan Rodgers, like, 1 week is regaling everyone of the master plan that conquered Pep. He's like Brendanus Maximus Meridius. And the next, you know, what we do in life echoes in eternity. And then very next week, he's sitting in detention at the David Moyes Institute of Online Learning. Like, this is just, has there ever been a fall in football quite like it? Like, it's just, it makes no sense at all. You know, before then, you know, Man United lost 3-1 at home to Palace. I suppose that's a kind of result that may even have been a result that happened the previous season. But like the Carabao results, I think Liverpool scored 7 in the Carabao. So they've both scored and conceded 7 in the handful of games they've played this season. Tottenham scored 7 in their previous match in the Europa League. You know, Bayern scored 8 against Schalke in the first Bundesliga match this season, in addition to their 8 that they scored against Barcelona. They've also lost 4-1 to Hoffenheim, Bayern did, and only won last night 4-3. So, like, even the best team of, like, the last several years is showing signs of, we don't really know what we're doing right now. You know, and, I mean, I don't know. Like, I mean, does everyone score more in training? I do think there's, yeah, I was about to say, it should be easier to sort of stay composed in matches. But like, how would that then translate into like 7 and 8 nil thrashings?
Well, maybe the attackers are staying composed in front of goal.
Composure is the last thing you need, apparently.
Defenders, not so much.
Composure, yeah. I mean, when you're watching Liverpool last night, you're like, do they have a worse COVID problem than they think they do? we've seen this happen a few times. I mean, I'm not necessarily suggesting that like Joe Gomez and Trent Alexander-Arnold were doing the Sir Jorah Mormont on it. You know, where they were like, you know, like
They were both wearing long sleeves, weren't they?
Covering up. Well, I mean, it is a different disease, of course. But like, you're just kind of saying, how can they be this bad? Like, what is actually happening here? I did ask Stephen Kenny why this was going on yesterday at the Ireland press conference. I thought I'd get his thoughts on why there had been so many crazy. You know, why there seems to have been such strange results and outlandish. I mean, this was before the two afternoon evening, you know, the 6-1.
It was a Sunday, early Sunday presser, yeah.
Yeah, it was like 2 o'clock on Sunday. But even already, it was basically, you know, they've had record goal scoring weeks in the Premier League and all this kind of thing. Like, have you seen any ways in which the lack of crowds at the games is actually beginning to change what happens on the pitch? And he said, well, that's a deep question and an interesting one, but I'm kind of here to talk about Ireland. So, you know, thanks for that. And best of luck with that one.
So, Richie's on with us. Yeah, we'll get more from Stephen Kenny, I'm sure.
The high scores haven't affected the Ireland games just yet. Maybe that's all to come this week.
Maybe so. We'll see, because Richie's on with us today before his attention turns later this week to the international football, as will ours. Loads of build-up to Thursday's playoff against Slovakia will be available on the World Service in the next few days, and a full football podcast on Friday to react to whatever happens. €5 a month plus VAT is all it costs to sign up, and you can do that on secondcaptains.com. Also coming up this week. Episode 6 of Where's George Gibney provoked incredibly strong reactions from a lot of you, really, ranging from heartbreak for the young swimmer whose story was told to massive anger at the way Gibney destroyed her life. Now, episode 7 is going to be out this Thursday, and there's loads of new information in this one discovered. Mark talks to people who have never spoken before on the Gibney case, as well as a new discovery on Gibney's life today. So lots of interesting stuff there. That's Thursday, wherever you normally listen to your podcasts. Let's report on a crazy weekend's football, please, Ken.
So someone tweeted us, is it finally time to give Villa some coverage? Sleeping giant, manager, captain, both boyhood fans. Hopefully Grealish is still a Villa player by the end of the day. Owners willing to invest, never mind Leeds or Everton. This is the real lockdown season story. Leeds, Everton and Villa are...
That's Mark Johnson to give this gentleman his due.
These are the... Maybe a season of very strange football, but it also has football heritage. in the form of Leeds, Everton, and the resurgent Aston Villa. I mean, I do feel like we are watching a lot of fake football, though. I'm sorry to... It feels fake. It feels like as fake as the fake noise that they ridiculously continue to... Like, has that not just reached a point of such nonsense at this stage? Just so stupid. Why are we doing this? Like, just play what's actually happening. You don't need to make this, like, hyper-real fake reality. Like, by pretending to have crowds, which we don't have. Like, it's just so sad now. Like, there haven't been crowds in months. Everyone's got used to the fact that there's no crowd. And yet they're still playing this moronic sound. And on a channel like the BBC. Like, whatever about a trash channel like BT Sports, right? Which is just like a, you know, it's like a pay TV sports channel. You know, recently established.
Pay TV. Trash is a bit strong there. I mean, it's pay TV.
Yeah, but, you know, come on, BT Sports. Like, it's no one's idea of like, oh, I look to BT Sports for like standards in objectivity in journalism. You know, it's not that type of a channel. You know what I mean? It's just not. Whereas the BBC are supposed to be, like, I mean, especially an organization as embattled as they currently are, apparently doesn't consider it, like, in any way ethically questionable that they just broadcast this fake stuff. Like this moon landing.
What's the ethics? Everyone knows it's fake when they're watching it. It's not as though the BBC are trying to tell you there's a crowd there.
Everyone knows it's fake. What next? Boris Johnson. Like roars of applause for Boris Johnson.
Why do people care so much about the fake crowd? Well, I suppose with Match of the Day, you don't get a choice whether or not to watch it. Is that your problem? Because
you don't. I mean, but the apparent assumption that this is the default way that people want to watch it, as opposed to the way that it actually is.
It's really grim watching it as it actually is, though. Really grim.
It's not grim, Owen. Like this is reality. Let's face it. Like the grimness is like this idea that we need this like fake noise to like make this bearable to watch. When in fact, I'm just shut up noise. I want to hear what they're screaming at each other. I want to hear the curses. That's the one advantage of this is that I can hear exactly what Luke Shaw is screaming at Harry Maguire after that first goal goes in by Ndombele.
It feels like this is a conversation we had 3 months ago, and I don't think.
Yeah, but it's got more and more absurd as time goes on. It's just more and more pathetic and embarrassing and ridiculous and sickening to watch, and in my opinion, destructive of the, you know, to be fair, rapidly degenerating and disintegrating reputation of, you know, a once august organization like the BBC. You know, BT Sports, they can do whatever they want, and at least they give you the option to watch the other channel where they haven't added the fakeness. But like I think it's a bad trend. And you're saying, oh well, we've already talked about this. I'm saying no, we need to keep our eye on this. Like this is like, you know, it starts with this, and let's see what other aspects of reality we can just massage. And people go, well, everyone knows it's
no, they're
fake.
Responding like, to a very specific set of circumstances, and that is that there's no crowds in the venues and they're trying to give some semblance. Oh look, the problem some with talking
of,
this
No
stuff,
no, finish that thought.
Some semblance of the feel you get when normally watching a game of football, as opposed to, look, what are these magic things that all these players are shouting to each other? They still haven't heard it. Okay, fine. There was one payoff maybe with Klopp telling Lampard to stand down, or vice versa, I should say. Lampard telling Klopp to stand down. I've watched other games, full games with no crowd noise. And
what about
I'm not
Sean
hearing
Dyche?
Very interesting things being shouted.
What about Sean Dyche screaming at Raheem Sterling?
Over games. Look, the problem when you're having this argument is it comes across as saying, as sounding like I'm saying that fake crowd noise is amazing. It's the way football should always be. Never bring the crowds back. I mean, it's not great at all, but it's just the marginally least worst of the two options, I feel.
Well, okay, we disagree, but this may not be the last time this comes up. I know, even though we've talked about it.
We could talk about it on some other weekend with Liverpool having beaten 7-2.
Sorry, that was my point. Yeah, that was my point about not talking about it today. It's like there's a lot to get into here.
Well, it's of a piece with the general ersatz nature of what we are watching. So what is this? What's this 7-2 nonsense all about? You know, I mean, I was sitting there trying to write an article about how useless Ole Gunnar Solskjaer was. But unfortunately, this match was going on in the background, and every goal that went in just completely undercut. I was like, well, what can I really say here? Like, you know, I was going to go really strong, but I've actually got to tone this down now. Because this is just, it's clear that, like, What in the cold light? I mean, you saw Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's ashen-faced performance after this game, where he's like, "It's the worst moment of my career. It's the worst moment." Well, not of the club's history, because he kept referring a few times to the previous 6-1, which I assume is what he was referring to. He did mention the 6-1 specifically a couple of times, but you know, it suddenly appeared rather different. It suddenly just seemed like the sort of thing that just happens these days. Mm. You know what I mean? By the end of the Liverpool match, even though it's a different match, I mean, we'll talk to Rishi about these two matches. It's a different match, different circumstances. It's still, though, it's like, yeah, it's kind of a similar type of thing to happen there. What was happening? Like, it's like when you see a game like with this many mistakes, with this many goals, with that insane of a scoreline, it's like, how do you even analyze that? Like, well, where do you start with that? I guess you can start with Adrian. Klopp is saying after him, everyone made massive mistakes. The first was obviously Adrian, but the reaction around the goal was an even bigger mistake. We have to take risks. That's normal, but we have to protect the risks. We didn't do that. Every ball we lost was a massive counterattack. People will say things about Adrian now. The first goal was not good, but he didn't have anything to do with the other goals. We didn't help him. He's a really good goalie. Last year, we played 11 games with him and won pretty much all of them. Didn't win the Atletico Madrid game, as I recall, which was the last game before lockdown. Our goalie was not the problem. It is not often I've seen games like this, although I'm old enough to know strange things can happen in football. Is it a one-off? I would like to think so, but the proof of that will be in the next couple of weeks or months. Anyway, he's saying Adrian's a really good goalie, but they're also linked with Gazzaniga today. We'll see if they sign a goalkeeper, but with Alisson out for 6 weeks, it seems like that might be something they'd have to do. But you know what he's saying there about the every ball we lost was a massive counterattack. This was sort of the pattern of it. It's, you know, Liverpool play this game where they really crowd the opposition. It's all about like denying space to the opposition. But once you can get out of that little box they tried to put you in, it suddenly transpires that you now have the entire pitch to do as you like, because all of the Liverpool players have been trying to squeeze you into that little box, and there's none of them left over for the rest of the space. So this was the thing that kept happening. I mean, Klopp was like, "It was not sloppy tonight, like Mr. Keane said. It was just, it was just bad."
He looked at the camera when he said that. Mm. I don't know if he was. He might have thought Mr. Keane was in studio again.
I'd say Mr. Kane's definitely seen it by now.
Yeah.
It was not sloppy tonight. It was just bad. I would love to have a training session tomorrow and work on it, but we can't because of internationals. What was a standout feature of the game, I thought, was just how dangerous Aston Villa were from every single throw-in they had in the game. I don't think I've ever seen a game where throw-ins caused such lethal danger to the other side. And this was like, because every time Villa get a throw in, Liverpool squeeze over to one side to try and sort of box them into the throw in to get the ball back. And yet just never did this. So what kept happening was the ball would be thrown in, Villa would then get it and quickly transfer it out of the box, the very ineptly constructed box that Liverpool tried to put them in, to the free man streaking through on the far side. You know what I mean? Like the Grealish goal is the best example of it. Like, you see how far infield Trent Alexander-Arnold is. He's the last man. He's the last man that the ball goes past. I think he's to the left of the center circle. You know what I mean? Like, he's all the way over, and Grealish is just there. He's just waiting. Like, if we can just get the ball from that side of the pitch to my side, this is going to be a goal. And that's exactly how it turned out. There were so many of these sorts of chances.
Well, is there an argument that some of the, if you look at the player, a number of the Liverpool players are, for whatever depth they think they have or are trying to build, are absolutely vital to this thing. And the one that was made a big deal out of last night was Mane, because he leads that press and he does, they're more successful at boxing players in when he's leading it, and he's aggressive enough to do that and all that kind of stuff. And also Jordan Henderson wasn't there. Maybe that was partly why there were gaps all over the place, when normally he has a positional awareness to cover those. Or is it too simplistic to just point to the one or two individuals?
Well, the players they were missing were Alisson,
Alisson as well, of course. Yeah,
I think Alisson is the biggest problem in terms of if you look at the squad that they have, if they lose Van Dijk, that's also a huge problem. But like, if they lose Alisson, then Adrian is the replacement. Whereas even with Mane, who is a brilliant player, like, Diogo Jota is not a bad replacement. You know what I mean? He's not Mane, but like, I don't think the drop off there is anything like as
no,
big.
But the point being made, I think it was Patrice Evra in particular, not the most explosive thing Patrice Evra said yesterday or over the last few weeks, but I think he was making the point that Mane loves pressing and does it with an aggression that, for all Salah and Firmino's pressing, we didn't quite say they only go through the motions, but he did say that Mane's the best at it and he's the trigger for everyone else to get involved.
I don't know about that. I don't know if that's really true, because I think in general that the three of them, that's one of their big strengths. I mean, certainly Firmino, it's like his main strength. I mean, if with Firmino, like, that's his whole brand is that. Like, certainly it's not, if you were writing the Roberto Firmino brochure, you wouldn't be like, our client scored 4 goals in 2020 in all competitions. You know, that wouldn't be wouldn't be something that you'd be talking about. You'd be talking about his
you'd
dynamic
want to be working hard
movement.
On the press.
4 goals in 2020. Like, at what point does that become a problem for him? You know what I mean? Certainly he didn't have a great game again yesterday. Although, again, if you concede 7 goals, there's a tendency to not concentrate so hard on the chances that were missed. I just saw Virgil van Dijk saying, "Oh, well, you know, we weren't good enough at the other end of the pitch either." And you're like, "Well, Virgil, you may have to take this one on the chin." There was the whole issue of the high line and defense, and I did think there was something to it. Like, again, you've got to separate it from, okay, this is what they're trying to. They are trying to do this deliberately. It's not just a case of like, oh my God, what's going on? They've lost the plot. Like, look at their line. This is like a deliberate strategy, but I do feel as though you can put it a little bit too high. Like the fourth goal, the Watkins header from close range. This was after the free kick when Van Dijk had fouled someone clumsily. Villa had that free kick, and the ball was, Trezeguet was able to play, was just so simple. Like, it was almost a through ball rather than, you know, usually if you're playing a free kick like that, you have to flight the ball. You know, you can't, because you can't get it through the defenders. You know, you have to put it over them. You have to sort of stick it up above to where they, so towards the back post or whatever. But he was able to just play a through ball. There was that much space that he was able to hit a ball hard enough to get through, but that still had enough space that it wasn't going to run out of play. That's what I mean.
Yeah.
And it was like, I mean, that's ridiculous. You know, you made it way too easy for, you've made it way too easy for them to get a really easy goal scoring chance here with that line. The whole purpose of it is to catch people offside, and Sky were showing those statistics that showed how extreme Liverpool are compared to almost every other team. Like, I think they had 155 offsides or something like this, which was, I think, nearly twice as much as the third place team. some crazy number like that. And the point of it, as we discussed before, is that there are no marginal offsides that go in the opposition's favour anymore because of VAR, at least in theory. They're going to catch 100% of the offsides. Therefore, you can play this way and it's not going to be like undermined by the mistakes of a linesman. But still, if everyone knows that's what you're going to do, then they can prepare to a set piece to expose exactly the frailty that you now create by doing that. And that's what Villa did. And, you know, it was a crazy, insane game. And just after, you know, Liverpool had kind of established themselves as looking like absolute red-hot favourites for the title by beating Chelsea and then Arsenal and looking in control of those games throughout, they now suddenly, it's the whole thing is back up for grabs. It's like, hang on, do they actually remember how to defend? And if Adrian is going to be the goalkeeper, you know, their next game is against Everton, who obviously are top of the league, haven't beaten Liverpool in a good while, and will be absolutely desperate to do so. Imagine they lose that game.
Yeah.
And suddenly they're right back. You know, City can go ahead of them again. Even Chelsea could go ahead of them again. Everton, meanwhile, would have built a lead. And in a season as kind of crazy as this, like, who knows what's going to happen?
Like, the tactical issues you described there are, that it makes sense, right? And if we were sitting here talking after Liverpool had been beaten, say, 3-2 or something, or, you know, 2-1, I'd be thinking, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, no, I can see why that happened. But just to lose, to concede that many goals, it is basically impossible to analyse. You know, you can't legislate for conceding 7 goals, Jurgen Klopp might say. But you have to try to.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, you just sort of get it. I mean, Adrian is obviously the if you were to say, okay, what are our issues? There are a bunch of issues, but Adrian is kind of the simplest one. You know, there's Opta had the statistic. He's made 5 errors directly leading to goals in 21 appearances for Liverpool. Alisson has 92 appearances and has made the same number of errors directly leading to goals. So that's obviously a problem. And you also have the way in which it's now when he plays, that's what everyone expects to happen. You know what I mean? Both the opposition and his own teammates. Mm. So he's in that sort of zone of like the spiral of confidence. And that could be something they just have to deal with the next while. Or they could play a bit of Queevan Kelleher. Who knows?
His goalkeeping for the Ollie Watkins chance to hit the bar was quite interesting.
Unbelievable. Absolutely incredible. You saw where he was standing.
Yeah.
Like he ran out of his goal.
Describe it for Owen there, Ken, if he may not have seen it.
Did you see it? It was. I only actually realised how bad it was seeing a replay from, was it behind the goal?
Yeah, yeah.
And it was like, there was a sort of a diagonal cross coming in as Adrian is looking at it from left to right, diagonally sort of towards him. And Watkins is kind of coming towards or across the ball. But Adrian just sort of moved almost completely out of his goal to his right as though he was going to catch this ball. Watkins just came in and got his foot to it and put it off the crossbar when all you need to do is just get it anywhere underneath the crossbar and it's a goal because Adrian has moved completely out of the way.
At the moment that Watkins connected, it was the kind of the volley chance that hit off the bar. Watkins was basically where the penalty spot was and Adrian was in line with the right-hand goalpost. Yeah. That was how far over to the right he was as the chance was going directly from the penalty spot to the centre of the goal.
Could be worse for them. They could have Jordan Pickford in goals. How Everton... Jordan Pickford at the weekend was like, you know those machines in arc... How 1980s does this sound? But you know those machines, those boxing... You basically run up and take a big punch at this... You know, speedball type thing. And people always think they're going to really leather it, but it seems to be kind of hard to register a really high thing. It looked as though Pickford repeatedly was running up to that and trying to swing a haymaker and barely making contact as he was punching balls away. He probably got a combined distance from about 4 punches of about 3 feet, all of them to onrushing attackers. But we're moving all over the place. Let's actually get on to Manchester United and Spurs again. The other remarkable result of the weekend, complete with some remarkable television punditry, of course.
Well, the punditry was kind of incredible, wasn't it? Like, I mean, you do wonder if Sky are kind of thinking, well, there are no crowds. Obviously, there's the fake. Yeah, okay. But we've got to bring the emotion. And so let's get our TV pundits to really perform. And, you know, Patrice Evra has just been an absolute revelation. I mean, this is... You might have seen Evra. Evra sort of was saying, look, don't put me on United games anymore. He was saying in this, like, kind of... I guess... Yeah, he was exaggerating. Well, I don't even know what you... It's not exactly ironic. I prefer to comment on a different game than a United game if I keep working for Sky because basically I can't... There's nothing I can say about this club that won't hurt me and them. Mm. You know, and I love the club so much. He goes on and this is like the next thing he said.
Nothing. Nothing. I'll be honest, I feel sad also for the manager, but after we're going to start to talk about the manager and he's going to be the next one. But what about the board? It's how many years since Ferguson left, how many managers we've been sacked? So that's the solution. Every year, we're going to talk about Ole is not the man. Maybe he's not. Maybe it is. But we don't know about the transfer. We don't know if he's just a puppet. We don't know because he wants like player like Sancho and they don't go for the right price. It's like I'm going to buy a car. I know the price. And I say, no, I'm beating like less. But what's going on with my club? What's going on today? I'm really emotional right now. Seriously, Dev. And it's difficult to broken mind like me. I'm a positive person. But I don't...
Well, let's
need,
try.
Like, I don't promote the violence. But many people need like some good slap right now in this club. That's what I will do right now if I'm working for the club.
Well, when I saw that, I mean, I thought... There's only one other man in the punditry game who can hit those kinds of heights.
You see earlier, yeah, when we was in the fucking bar, yeah, a man come up to me and said, I'm making the club poisonous, yeah? I'm not making it poisonous. This fucking fraud is making it poisonous, yeah? 10-2 on aggregate in 2 years, blood. 10-2, blood, yeah? We moved to Emirates to compete with this. You call that competing? We can't ever compete with fucking Leicester, let alone fucking Bayern Munich, blood. It's a fucking joke. I've had enough of this shit, blood. He needs to fuck off, blood. I'm done with this shit, Rob. The man's a fraud, blood. I've been saying it for fucking months, blood. The man's a fucking fraud, blood.
Oh, troops. I actually thought you were going for his, for Ever's Sky Sports colleague, Roy Keane, who recently called for, was it David De Gea, to get smacked around a little bit. No, you've gone for troops there. Oh, yeah, that's okay.
Well, I just thought, just thought this is what it's about. Like, I mean, this is the ultimate triumph of AFTV. You know, this is, they're beginning to sort of dictate the, they've changed the culture, is what I'm saying. I mean, what Keane does is just looking a little bit outdated at this stage, I'm afraid. You know, he occasionally gets angry, but like, I mean, look at him when Klopp had a pop at him the other day. You know, he was saying, look, you know, you're saying we're sloppy. You're saying we're sloppy. Like, Keane should have turned around and called Klopp a ham roll. You know, he should have just called him a ham roll and told him where to go, instead of like being sort of apologetic and saying, well, actually, I've given your team a lot of praise. You know, like, forget all that. Like, it's just about, just stay on the front foot, Roy.
The best bit with Ever was nearly before he even started talking, because at full time, the first questions were directed towards Graeme Souness for some reason. I don't know if Dave Jones was giving Ever a moment to collect himself, but Souness was kind of referencing Ever as he was talking, and the camera would pan to Ever, and he just looked, his body language was brilliant. He just looked in physical pain. His eyes were watering. He's rubbing his chin. He starts staring at the ground. Oh, there was anger burning off him, and you thought he's going to say something.
Well, that's why all these things reminded me of the Super Trooper, because that was his sort of the stagey emotion was exactly what I associate with a great performance such as Troops or James Brown. You know, when James Brown is carried off the stage after just putting everything into his performance. I mean, that's what Everett was doing. Like, I mean, it was just. It's
someone should have draped his suit jacket around his shoulders.
Absolutely,
trying to wheel the chair out of the screen.
That is absolutely what he's doing here, and you know it's working. I'm sorry to report it's working. Ever is
making a name for himself.
He's swiftly becoming the top dog at Sky, and this is even though Gary Neville was described the club's. I read in the Daily Mirror the club's hierarchy. That's the Man United club hierarchy. Believe public outbursts by Gary Neville have been both inflammatory and disturbing. Well, Gary Neville commentated on that match like a man who was aware that people in the club hierarchy had been briefing that he was inflammatory and disturbing. By the way, that he just attacked them for everything and didn't seem to be like... barely mentioned it, like anything below board level, it's like it didn't matter.
Yeah, so we're going to talk to Richie about Solskjaer in quite a lot of depth, because Richie has been vocal in his views on Ole Gunnar Solskjaer on the show before.
So like, where do you start? Like, United have now also let in 11 goals, same as Liverpool. Now if you've got to go back to January to find 11 goals that they let in last season, like that is 17 matches. They let in 11 goals in the last 17 matches of last season, and they've conceded 11 in the first three of this season. They've lost two out of the first three, the same number as they lost of that last 17 as well. So two out of 17 becomes two and three. Now, the problem with losing two and three is that very quickly the whole season starts to look like, oh, no. Oh, no. Season is not going to be good. Like... they lost two and three of the 2018-2019 season when Mourinho's last half season as manager. And one of them was actually a 3-0 home defeat to Tottenham, if you remember the 3-0 defeat they suffered on that occasion. And by December, they'd lost seven and Jose was out of there. But really, the tone was kind of set. You know, the tone was set early and it was like, this is... We feel like we're already up against it now. A bit like in a game like that where you have setbacks and you're like, oh, we're, you know, once it went 3-1 and United were down to 10, you know, even actually when they went down to 10 so early in the game and they were already 2-1 down, you thought, okay, they're probably going to lose this game. Then when it's 3-1 immediately after that, you're like, not only are they going to lose this game, but this game is going to be really, really traumatic.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? You knew that. It's like they have no chance. But they have to get through to full time now, and this could get really ugly. And, you know, that was the sort of position they're in. Now, the kind of what Solskjaer has to try and do is prevent the whole season from starting to look a bit like that in the minds of his players. You know, like the whole thing is like some kind of desperate rear guard action in which United are sort of outmatched by, you know, Chelsea have spent like £250 million, by the way. You know, that's what Chelsea have done. When you add in Mendy to players that they had already bought. So you could say they've strengthened. You can see that Arsenal with Arteta have, you know, there's a certain, you know, aren't they won again? They've obviously had a much better start so far, only after a couple of games. But they do seem to be making some progress. You know, he already won the FA Cup. And there seems to be a sort of a brain power in evidence there. You know what I mean? Which... It's just when you consider how, and even someone like Leicester, and then you've got like what Everton are doing, you're kind of like, well, is how long are they going to be able to keep that up? You know, could they, it's suddenly like, are we even going to make it into the top four? Never mind the title. That's the sort of situation that they're in. There's all this talk about, oh, they're, you know, the signings, and today is the deadline day, and we'll see who they bring in. But, you know, what are they doing so far? Alex Telles from Porto, basically a replacement for Luke Shaw, I guess. Edinson Cavani, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, I think would have been a pretty good signing for Manchester United. Edinson Cavani now, it's very hard to say what kind of player they're really going to be signing. I mean, you would have thought that when the experiences that they've had with guys like Falcao and Alexis Sanchez, superstar players arriving on high wages, towards the back end of their careers. None of these have been successful yet. Cavani, I think, is a player who has always seemed like he should be a successful player in the Premier League, you know, in terms of he's big and strong and all these types of things. And he has scored a lot of goals in his career. I mean, he's PSG's top scorer. He broke Zlatan's record there. He has been a phenomenal goal scorer. If you compare him to all the other players who've played in Europe over the same time, he is one of the top goal scorers, maybe just short of the bracket of, you know, the sort of Lewandowski, Suarez bracket, but nearly there. But the fact is that last season, he scored only 4 goals. He made 7 starts in the league, which was his worst since 2010. You know, he had the fewest minutes since 2010. The fewest minutes and goals in the league since 2007. And last season before was his worst for minutes since 2008. So you can kind of see like, so what I'm saying is, he's going back to zero.
Yeah, and the point was made that this guy's been available on a free transfer for, you know, the entire transfer window.
Yeah, it's not really a free transfer though. In the sense that, like, he is wages. Free, but his brother/agent is going to need £10 million to sprinkle agent magic on the deal and make it happen.
Yeah, but if Solskjaer, as a great striker himself, recognized this is the guy who's going to transform our fortunes, the deal might well have been done a long time ago, as opposed to it looking like maybe they just need to sign somebody.
But how is this guy going to transform their fortunes? Like, I don't really get it. Like. I mean, yeah, okay, he's another option, which is useful, but like there are worrying things about this team at the moment. I mean, what's happening with the thing that they have to really cling to at the moment is, look, this is just the way football is now, right? We're in this weird space, like, because everything that I'm about to say about Manchester United, you could also say about Liverpool, but the strength of the team last season was actually the defense. The strength of the United team. Like, I know that last season, the exciting thing about the team was the emergence in the second half of the season of this front three, including Greenwood and Bruno Fernandes, scoring a lot of goals. But the basis of their success, such as it was in finishing third, was the defense. They conceded, like, the same number of goals as Liverpool and City. Like, well, Liverpool 33, City 35, United 36. So, broadly comparable. And those three teams were way better than any other team, defensively. Attack-wise, they scored 66. So, that was, like, 20 less than Liverpool, nearly 40 less than City. So, there was a big gap in their attacking production. You know, attack-wise, they were kind of similar to some of the teams around them. It was the defense that was what that was the strength. If that's now disintegrating, and I'm like, some of the play was just so bad. You know, from Maguire was so bad. De Gea, I thought, was really poor on the Son goal. Like, you've got to, I thought it was terrible. You know, there was so many things went wrong with that Son goal that it's unfair to single out De Gea, because, like, first of all, what's Maguire doing? You know, why are you letting him take a quick free kick when you're standing where you are on the field? You know what I mean? He backed off Harry Kane instead of getting in Harry Kane's way.
Yeah.
Wan-Bissaka did the same thing. Eric Bailly didn't react to the run that Son made. But then De Gea is watching Son come through. And the only one thing should be on his mind here is, like, when can I... Am I going to advance at this player who's coming at me with the ball? If I do that, that has to happen in the fraction of a second that he takes a touch, and it's a bad touch. And Son did that, and De Gea reacted way too late, so that by the time he actually got out to the ball, Son was clipping it over him. You know
what
I mean?
He had actually done was he initially when he saw Son being released, he backpedaled.
He retreated.
He actually retreated, and so he was starting from that. Then he starts going, exactly. So it wasn't even just hesitating; it was going backwards to go forwards.
There was. I mean, he needed to get back into his goal, I suppose. But then it's a case of, am I going to rush at the guy or not? And if you're going to do that, then there's a time when you can do it, and then there's a time when you've left it too late to do it and you shouldn't now do it. And that's the time De Gea chose to do it. But look, again, 6-1, you can't really just blame David De Gea. Pogba, the penalty Pogba gave away, it's just like an absolute clown car moment. Like, it was just one of those, like, what is happening here? Like, if you just saw that footage, just that close-up of Davis... And then Pogba suddenly appears in the picture, like, sliding on his side, just sliding sideways.
You conceded a penalty with your rib cage on the ground. Like, it's just...
How does this happen?
And it was still only the fourth stupidest thing that a Man United player did in the act of conceding a goal. You can talk all you like about Solskjaer and about Ed Woodward, and, you know, many people will. But, like... Harry Maguire is the most expensive defender in the world, and he's currently, like, your comparison of him and Shane Duffy last year is starting to look very, very unfair on Derry's favourite son.
Well,
it's starting to look very unfair on Shane Duffy.
I mean, Maguire, to be fair to Maguire, like, he did play pretty well last season. Like, you know, he played nearly every minute, which is one important thing to be able to do of the game. He became the captain and so on. The team wasn't conceding that many goals, and in fairness, that had to do also with the type of way that Solskjaer had set up the team. It wasn't as though he was being asked to play a real high wire, you know, high line sort of thing most of the time, Harry Maguire. So there was an element of protection there, but to give him his credit, like, he did perform well at the center of that team structure. Since then, he's had the whole Greece thing, you know, the whole, like, I didn't know if he was having a flashback there. He thought Shaw was one of the police assailants or whatever when he grabbed Shaw and started roughing him up. Like, why are you trying
to
take
down Shaw?
Is this
even a real penalty area?
Is this a penalty area? What's going on here? Who are these people?
Luke Shaw is a fake Man United player. Tackle him now.
He's a playing close. I mean, it was just, like, it was amazing, amazing stuff. Again, like, is it a chance now for Solskjaer to sort of reset things, to say, okay, you've made it a complete bollocks of the first section of the season, but it's over now. We can catch our breath and we go again. Because one thing is for sure, absolutely everybody is going to make a complete ass of themselves at repeatedly over the season. It's going to happen to everybody. So that's what this season is about. It is a clown car race, and we've got as big a chance of anyone of staying involved. So if he can do that, yeah, maybe. I don't know.
You know what we need to stabilize things, to bring us back to reality? International football, Ken. Into the madness steps international football this week. You said you were...
Why is international football being played?
Why is it being played at all?
Well, like, it just... When you look at all of these things that are happening at the moment, like, say... did you see the incident in Italy where Juventus turned up at the stadium wearing like their club blazers and everything to play a game that they knew was not going to happen, because Napoli have been told by the local health authority in Naples not to travel for their game because they've had players test positive for COVID, and the health authority has told them to isolate. But Juventus are saying, well, actually, that's not the protocols. We're now going to observe the protocol by naming our team, getting on the bus, putting on our blazers, going to the bus, turning up, and then you don't show up and we get the 3-0 win.
Right.
I mean, okay, so this is a big argument now. Napoli are saying, no, you know, screw you. If the health authorities say this, then what are we going to do? You know, who do you think we are? So that's going to be a thing that's going to have to be sorted out. There was a match between Crewe and Oxford where Crewe turned up at Oxford United and they said, we can't play. We've had players test positive. We don't know how many other players are positive. We can play you if you want, but like, you could be getting a few positives yourself if you want to go ahead with that. I don't know if you saw the incident in rugby premiership where Sale Sharks had 16 players test positive.
Yeah.
Like, okay, so 16 players, they're still saying, oh, we can still play because we've got like loads of youth players and stuff. We don't need to forfeit fixtures.
But there would be a slight concern about the security of your bubble though, Sale.
Yeah,
let's be honest here. I mean, I've got some questions.
And the club apparently are looking into some rumours of a 6 a.m. party involving most of their squad, which may have had something to do with this mass.
No, we didn't have a party. We just announced a Supreme Court nominee. That's all.
But like, so this sort of stuff is going on, right? Showing the kind of extremely difficult to control contagion, which, you know, is still sort of on the right. I mean, there was a story there that the UK's case rate has been much higher than they thought it was for the last while, because like, someone didn't realize that like the Microsoft Excel document they've been putting it in had reached its maximum column width or something, or there was a maximum number of columns and it wasn't updating, like with about 15,000 new cases or some nonsense like this. So one of the main stories in today's Sun in the UK is one about three young international footballers, Ben Chilwell. Well, let me just read the furious Gareth Southgate will tell his England players to stop embarrassing themselves. Stop embarrassing themselves? How are they embarrassing themselves? Tammy Abraham, Ben Chilwell and Jadon Sancho were pictured breaking COVID rules by going to a party, despite six people being the limit of socialising. And then they've got pictures of Abraham, Chilwell and Sancho. Apparently it's a surprise birthday for Abraham. There's a quote from an unnamed friend of Abraham saying, we just wanted to do something nice for him for his birthday. But in hindsight, maybe it wasn't the best thought out thing to do, like to organise a big house party. The England boss will not, quote, read the riot act, unquote, to his players. Wouldn't be his style, would it? But we'll warn them firmly that they have to behave. I mean, this is just like, remember, he's thrown Greenwood and who was it? Foden out,
yeah.
For breaking the rules when they were in Iceland. And now, like, another three of his sort of top young players are involved in this. He's like, oh, what am I going to do? But the point about this is, whatever about how Southgate deals with it, you know, I'm sure everyone will be able to get through it. Those players could be playing, or England are playing Wales on Thursday, I think it is. Then Ireland are playing Wales on Sunday. And, I mean, in theory, as long as the game goes ahead, because under level 5 restrictions, which are being discussed at the moment, apparently there's not supposed to be any sport even on the level of Ireland matches.
Yeah, so if you know, and as we record, there's no decisions been made as to how the government are handling this curveball thrown at them by NPHET over the weekend. But level five, no matches or events to take place. Level 4, for example, as a comparison, there's no matches or events to take place, but then there is an exemption for professional and elite sport, inter-county, senior club championship, horse racing. They all would take place behind closed doors. But yeah, level 5. So Ireland, Wales, I mean, can't take place in the Aviva, can't take place in Ireland anyway if level 5 is enacted.
Was to be applied in the way that it's supposed to be.
Unless they come up with it, you know, level 5, but then they decide, you know, who knows what they decide. Like, they could add on an exemption retrospectively or something, but who knows.
But like, you know, it seems to me that, okay, Ireland could be working away doing their COVID bubble and everyone's being very disciplined and James McLean is wearing his tricolour mask every minute of the day and it's all fine. But we're also still depending on like Ben Chilwell and Jane Sancho and Tammy Abraham, you know, that whoever organized the surprise party also organized the biosecure bubble, so that guys like that, for instance, don't play against Wales, who then play against us. You know, you see the point that I'm making here. Like, international football, Ireland playing in three different countries in a week, jetting around from Slovakia to Dublin and then to Helsinki and then back to their clubs. It just is like, this is obviously not really compatible with trying to contain the contagious spread of a disease. You know, so what I'm saying is, I don't really, when you see the things that have already started to happen, you know, during the sort of project restart and so on, the Premier League seemed quite immune from this. But remember, there was no internationals. There wasn't like lower league football. There wasn't cup football. There was maybe a higher standard of rigor being applied at every level by all the participants. But now it's clear there's a bit of relaxation has come into it. There's a lot more football happening. And every time
there's a lot more going on in society in general, or at least they're theoretically.
Yeah, I mean, just the fact is, you know, you're playing against the team, like you're sharing the pitch with them. Every time that happens, there's another chance for whoever is. I'm not saying people are doing the Jorah Mormont on it en masse, but every match is a chance for the virus to grow. So,
you're really building up
what I would say is
let's enjoy this madcap season while it continues to go ahead, because with these sorts of incidents happening, you're just sort of wondering, like, with the calendar as compressed as it is, and if teams have to postpone games, if entire squads are wiped out by positive tests and so on and so forth, then where are you going to fit in those games? How are you going to make them up? You know, you're going to have to start cancelling things. You know, in order to, if you want to fulfill league fixtures, you're going to have to start cancelling other things. So, that's where it's at right now.
Just a crying big baby.
But you cannot call a player a baby. What?
Is the game you wanted a victory, but it didn't happen? What happened?
I want victory for every game.
Where do you think you got it all wrong today?
Which is the game you wanted a victory, but it didn't happen? What happened?
Well, it's just the nervousness.
You look frustrated on the
Coach.
Pitch.
Which is the game you wanted a victory, but it didn't happen? What happened?
You wanted victory.
Well, I wanted victory.
Which is the game you wanted a victory, but it didn't happen? What happened?
Where do you think you got it all wrong today?
Won against them in the Premiership, and we never said they are baby.
He's just a crying big baby.
And you cannot call a player a baby.
Okay, we need a voice of reason, a voice of sanity to try to help us all get back on an even keel here and make some sense of what's going on in the world of football, maybe the world at large. Who knows what Richie Sadler can do for us today. How are you, Richie?
Lads, how are you getting on? You well?
We're okay. How are you? Did you enjoy that that weekend's football?
I did. I loved it. In the last few weekends, actually, I've made a big effort to spend as much time in front of the telly as I can, watching as much football as I kind of to counter the heaviness that comes with my other work, particularly during a pandemic. So I was delighted that I didn't have to catch up on this on Match of the Day or just catch the highlights. I saw it all unfolding. It was incredible. I don't know, like Klopp's answer after the game, he says, I'll tell you what I saw, but I'm going to find it hard to explain it. but it was remarkable. Like, 16 goals in two games, probably would it be the standout or kind of era defining defeats for the manager of Liverpool and United, like an hour and a half apart. And in the middle of it all, you had a pundit kind of negotiating the exit of his contract because he couldn't handle the emotion of it all. Like, it was amazing TV.
Do you want to start with him then? Do you want to start with Ever? What do you make of that?
well, I was sitting there going, Have I ever found it that difficult to sit and just talk about a game of football or be in a studio trying to compose my words? And there's been some challenging environments or working conditions that I've had to put up with in
I would say peak sort of tension with the panel old guard. I would imagine you might have been thinking whatever was thinking. Yeah, people never said it out loud live on television.
I swear to God, there was loads of moments where sitting there in the build up to the game or in the pre-show meetings or in the ad breaks or whatever, I'm sitting there going, why is this how I'm choosing to spend my life? There must be other ways. There must be other things here that is like. Anyway, we could do a whole podcast on that, but let's not.
It is sort of interesting, though, isn't it? How Evra, for some reason, is seeking to present himself as Manchester United's number one fan in the world.
Like, here's a question: what about just being a pundit? What about just analysing a game of football? Just tap into all your experience and knowledge and just try and make sense of what's in front of you and just have get some kind of handle on your emotions and realise you're not there as a supporter. You're not
there. Because people expect more. People expect more now. People want emotional involvement. You know, they want you to take a position. They want you to see, they want to see tears. I mean, crocodile tears, real tears. Who cares? You know, as long as you're weeping about something. Then, I mean, it is a bit more relatable, is it not? I mean, you can see it's sort of been successful all over Europe. The emotional, you know, La Emoción de Roncero, that the Real Madrid journalist who cries every time they lose. I mean, this is how to get the audience to engage.
Well, I'm on the Ireland-Slovakia game on Thursday, so I hope to God I'm not in tears by the end of it. But you're trying to say, is that maybe what the role is now demanding?
Well, I just can't remember seeing anyone, for instance, on RTE talking about Ireland doing that yet. And I'm kind of scratching my head thinking, when is someone going to pick up this ball?
Dunphy has gotten emotional on a couple of occasions over the years, it should be said.
That is true, actually. Dunphy has done. And in fairness, what Dunphy was doing there was not, like, I'm the number one fan of the Irish football team. Like, you know, your man Alan Hunter or whatever, who was on with him on TV a couple of times. Remember that guy? Where did you find this guy?
I have been next to pundits who will remain nameless, who the emotion and all the emotion and the intensity of their post-match comments did not come from the fact that their sense of how football should be played was affronted or the result impacted them. It was basically because of how it impacted the bets that they had on the football game. So there's lots of reasons why you can be really, really impacted by result. But yeah, Evra did position himself yesterday as being representative of all fans.
What did you make of the whole weekend? Was it particularly yesterday, the United and Liverpool defeats? Was it a peak football, Premier League entertainment, or was it just a little too slapstick? Did it seem almost unrealistic and actually hard to wrap your head around?
I think this. We should separate the two games. I mean, the Villa Liverpool game was. It was. I didn't hear anyone predict that it was on its way. Nobody was saying, you know, Liverpool are due a thumping someday. And even when you're watching it,
Roy Keane had pointed to some sloppiness, some signs of sloppiness at the back.
I don't think I've ever watched a game of football where you couldn't point at a passage of play and said, there's a bit of sloppiness. It's not possible for an hour and a half to avoid dropping a standard or misplacing a pass or not seeing a runner or miscontrolling something or missing a chance or coughing up a chance. That like saying spotting sloppiness in a game of football is like saying, you know, I've spotted 22 players. Like that, it's in every single game. But the Villa Liverpool one was, it just seems like, now maybe I'll be proved wrong and maybe this will be the start of a really difficult run for Liverpool, but it just, as I was watching it, it just seemed like this just seems like a freak. This isn't a, like, we'll talk about United in a moment, and I think you could spot a pattern there, and you could have, it's almost with United, it's like, who's responsible for this? Because there are so many culprits. There are so many people that you could point a finger at and say, you know, these guys are the reason that we're seeing this, and that this actually isn't hard to have predicted. But with Liverpool, you couldn't have predicted it. Like, there was so much conversation in Sky's coverage about the high line and the tactic of playing a high line or defending near the halfway line. And that on its own is not a reason, because Liverpool have been doing that for so long. For some reason, they just absolutely lacked an intensity or something that we've never questioned with Liverpool. They've always had it under Klopp that they just hound the person on the ball. And I think Evra used a phrase one time, like, no Mane, no party. Like, he kept pointing out the fact that Mane was missing and that was the thing that just kind of like kind of domino set everything off. So, well, if you miss that guy, everything else falls apart. But I think that's too simplistic as well. And I think Villa had one of those. I don't think Villa will have a performance like that again. They haven't been given those performances in a long time. And I think three of the goals were from big deflections. Like, there were just so many elements where you think, how is this happening in front of us? And by the end, like, you were looking at Klopp on the sideline, kind of laughing at times. Carragher himself was laughing, and I was sitting on the couch next to a wife who was utterly disinterested in the whole thing. But like, I was sitting there, do you know when you just want to have somebody with you who's watching this and who's sharing in this experience? And I was mad. Yeah,
sorry, Ken, I know you want to come in there, but I should mention that we had my mother over for dinner, and I felt kind of bad as I'm over at the, you know, having dinner. We had the posh table set up and everything, you know. And then I'm like, oh Jesus, I'm the TV's kind of on in the background, and I'm edging slowly over. I was a terrible son, that's all I'm saying. But she actually gets on well with my wife, so it's fine. They're having great chats. Sorry, Ken.
Well, that's good. That's good to know.
Yeah, family harmony is still intact, and I got to watch the second half at least.
You were saying, Richie, that it's hard to... I mean, we can get into the reasons why you think the United game belongs in a different category as opposed to being sort of more of the same freakish slapstick action. But like, if you're looking for patterns in what happened with Liverpool, I mean, if ever was saying no Mane, no party, no Alisson, no party.
Yeah.
I mean, or rather, no Alisson, let the party begin. Because, you know, he was obviously the goalkeeper in the last pre-lockdown match, the previous lockdown, of course, not the impending one that they're talking about over here. It seems to be a bad omen whenever Adrian gets between the sticks, not only for lockdowns in the Republic of Ireland, but for Liverpool letting in a bunch of goals. I mean, obviously, he gave away the first goal, and to give away a goal like that with such a stupid mistake very early does kind of set the tone a little bit. Now, Klopp was defending him after, saying, "Oh, you know, there's lots of other players. We won nearly every game he played, last season. You know, and it's not just about one player's mistakes. And that's a typical sort of thing for Klopp to say. At the same time, should they sign a goalkeeper today? Because Alisson apparently is going to be out for 6 weeks, and 6 weeks, I mean, 6 weeks, if it is only 6 weeks, it could be longer than that. And that's plenty of time for them to throw away the league title that they took so long to win back last season.
I think if there is a goalkeeper out there available that they can get today, I think absolutely they should get him. I don't think, like, they would have stayed in the Champions League last year. That Atletico Madrid defeat at home wouldn't have happened, I think, if Alisson was in goal. I think, again, I don't think Adrian alone was the reason that yesterday happened, but he was certainly a contributing factor. And I agree with Klopp, like, what he said after the game, said, yes, it was a mistake. Yes, he shouldn't have passed it. And yes, it led to the first goal. But that's not enough of a reason for everyone to collapse or to, did he say, lose the plot then after the first goal. But, like, Caoimhín Kelleher, as a supporting act, like, he's not good enough to stand in to a team who are chasing the title in the way Liverpool.
You say he's not good enough. You sound fairly confident about that judgment. I mean, he's in the Ireland squad. Caoimhín Kelleher, he's good enough to play for Ireland, and you're saying he's not good enough to play for a city side like Liverpool.
Well, at the moment, he's deemed inferior to Adrian by the people who see him every day. Whether that's his ability or his level of experience or his age or his personality, whatever the factors are, he's third. Now, Adrian at the moment, I'd worry for any defence who has to get used to playing in front of him. Like, whatever about accepting, you know, he's here today and the main man's back next week. But if it's going to be a 6 week period where he is the automatic starter, I you know, straight away, like, one of the things that I used to, and it's been steadily coming out over the last year or two, Liverpool have built up this aura around them, and the obvious comparison is, you know, the strongest United teams of the 90s, where you just think they're just gonna find a way and beat you. If they need a late goal, they'll get one. If they need a clean sheet, they'll do it. Whatever it takes, they'll just, there's an invincibility about them, and there's an inevitability that what they need is the thing that they'll go out and get. If you put him in goal, I think that, like, that massively starts to diminish, because you just think, okay, like, forget about describing this defence as being, like, all the best things we were saying about them in their best days over the last 18 months or 2 years. With him in goal, it just diminishes that aura so strongly. So if there's one available, and again, I don't know how available these people are at short notice, but they need to go out and get one.
I know you said that this isn't typical of Aston Villa performances. Maybe not last season, Richie, but they're going all right. And Jack Grealish in particular. How many assists?
I could watch him all day, every day.
You do like watching him play? Because there was a big period towards in the middle, sort of latter middle part of last season, where he wasn't producing, he wasn't getting assists or goals. Then he came good for them at the end, and seems he was it three assists yesterday, two goals, pretty good going. You could watch him all day, yeah.
Yeah. See the second, was it the second goal when
he put it through Van Dijk's legs, I think.
Yeah, and there was one where the finish where he just kind of seemed to kind of dink it, or just almost kind of like not taking the piss out of the keeper, but just like so nonchalantly just putting it to one side.
Yeah,
of
he kind of dinked it to the near side when it looked like the obvious finish was to curl it around him to the far post. He sort of let him go that way and then just did this gentle little chip to the near post.
He was like, obviously everyone's been talking about this fella for a long, long time, and in particularly in this country. But I think I said this before. I saw him at Millwall. Was it 2 years ago or something? He was playing for Villa, and do you know, you're watching again. Like he was so above all his Villa teammates and every one of the Millwall players. And Millwall actually won the game, I think. But he just had so many extra gears that he could tap into at any moment. It was only seeing him in 90 minutes, like where you can just keep your eye on him off the ball. You know, you're not dictated by where the TV director wants you to see. You're not just following the ball. It was just so impressive what he does. And the work rate he put in yesterday, I think Souness was having a pop at him after the game, kind of saying that he's now starting to put in the work, and that's the level of, like, work is required in all the games, but
such nonsense.
Yeah, he's
why is that? Why is that nonsense?
Because when has he not been putting in work on the field? Mm. He's continually been the most kicked player in English football for the last several years. Now, I'm sorry, but you literally can't do that unless you're working hard to get on the ball in the first place in order to be fouled. Like, I mean, just that statistic alone suggests that, like, the idea this guy is a lazy guy. I mean, if he's just standing there watching the game passing by, then no one's going to be kicking him up in the air. But he draws more fouls than anybody else in the game. That's because he's demanding a ball, getting on the ball the whole time. Like, as soon as saying, oh, he needs to run back and be a box to box player, like, I mean, why him? Like, I mean,
but he does do that. There was one passage of play, I think Liverpool, I think a Villa tack broke down, I think, on the left-hand side. And so I think it was Trent Alexander-Arnold or somebody started to come out with the ball. And Ross Barkley was the nearest player to him. Grealish was 15 yards ahead of him. And it was Grealish was the one who sprinted back, overtook Barkley. Fair enough, but he did that. And he was the one who was sprinting back to cover to get back into position and to put pressure on the man on the ball. And just thinking... And they were well ahead at this point. This is into the second half. And just think, work rate in this valley, that's not an issue with this guy.
Yeah. The finish that you mentioned, though, the goal that he scored, seemed to me like... I mean, okay, number one, it was...
I think it was the seventh goal.
It was, yeah. And it was a rerun of something that happened just a couple of minutes earlier when Watkins had got through for what would have been his fourth goal. And Adrian had actually saved his shot. He put it straight at him, pretty much. And then Grealish was through in a very similar situation and finished it really coolly. But I thought that, to me, looks like the kind of finish that doesn't happen in a stadium which is full of supporters. Like, I don't know why, maybe that's wrong, maybe Grealish would do that, but it just seemed like a kind of a...
Training ground finish?
Yeah, you know, it did seem... Like, I wondered what your impression is about that, Richie, because I don't mean necessarily specifically on that, but like the general training ground atmosphere of the games, because a lot of us are watching fake broadcasts where they are putting in... fake noise for some reason. Like, for instance, Match of the Day decide this is the way that it should be broadcast, which is just unbelievable to me, but let's not go back into that. But, you know, this is a fact. It is more like training that they're in. And I do wonder if these types of... If the blowouts that we're seeing, the massive scorelines that we're seeing a lot of, and the kind of shocking collapses that would never happen normally must have something to do with this.
I think it must do. The more difficult answer is to find out exactly how it's impacting, but there's a couple of things. When something goes wrong in a game, you concede a goalie, you miss a chance, you have a ropey spell, sometimes like the senior players or the vocal players can do a load of kind of enthusiastic and instructing everyone or kind of encouraging them to do better. But in many, many cases, it's your fans that step up and do that. They'll intimidate the opponent, they'll make some noise, or you just know from their presence. And maybe I'm more aware of this because at Millwall, you're hyper aware of your own fans' presence because they're such an influence on you. Because if you go from a really good spell to a bad spell, they'll turn on you straight away. So you've got to stay concentrated and focused. But that's not there anymore for anyone. So I think if you are having any kind of a ropey spell, you don't have that thing of a baying mob being on your case to make sure you're staying concentrated. Or you don't have a group of fans, not like a baying mob, but who are really supportive and encouraging and really vocal and loud and start singing your name or your team's name or start jeering the opponent, that they can actually impact the flow of the game. So you're just left then with what is like a pre-season behind closed doors game environment, which is like, which one of the struggles we always used to have with them was you kind of have to just on your own just be completely kind of self-motivated, that you're not bouncing off the energy in the stand, or you're not responding to being jeered, and you're not responding to being supported, and you just have to, in a really silent environment, which is really unusual in a game of football that matters, you have to go out and give it your all. You have to go in and you know, play out the scene in your head that, like, this is the most important thing I'm ever going to do. And some people can do that quite easily, and other people have relied on for years the presence of tens of thousands of fans being there as an indicator that this really matters. So when you've really spells in a game where things aren't going well or you're not up for it, I suppose you're playing against teams that are good enough that if they're on the game, all of a sudden you're 3-0 down.
Oh, I think a lot of football fans around the world would have liked to have seen a crowd at Old Trafford yesterday and seen how Jose Mourinho would have fed off that particular crowd after this 6-1 defeat. Richie, we mentioned Evra earlier on. I didn't hear much criticism from him, even in amongst all the anger. I didn't hear much criticism of the Manchester United manager. Gary Neville had a more controlled anger. Didn't hear him having a pop at the manager. So the players are getting in the neck. The owners are getting in the board and the ownership and Ed Woodward and basically everybody at the club, bar the tea lady and the manager, Richie, seems to be getting it. What is the story with Ole Gunnar Solskjaer as one of his foremost critics on the Second Captain's World Service?
Well, I think I characterised my views on Solskjaer in this podcast several months ago as like it was like a blind spot that I have. And I think I'm going to have to call it something else. It's just the truth, right? Like, he's... Like, whoever yesterday, whether it was Neville or Evra or anyone watching the game, you can obviously make a very legitimate argument that Ed Woodward isn't doing what he's required to do. Like, it could be your first game of football that you've ever seen yesterday and you could spot that the Man United players aren't doing what they're meant to do. But then if you take a step back and look at Solskjaer, and don't look at yesterday's performance as a one-off game or a game in isolation or, you know, the result of an early sending off and blah, blah, blah. Like, did you watch them at home against Palace? Like, did you watch them away against Brighton? Did you watch them yesterday? There's a pattern emerging there. They don't look like a team. Like, what's the biggest thing that we've said about Lampard? Like, he's got all these kind of new toys to play with and he's got too many changes and it's an unsettled team and he hasn't had time yet to work out all his players and put them all into the same team and get them to click. Like, Solskjaer, like, has a settled squad. He's known them for quite a while. Like, there are no big, like, disruptions by new arrivals or big departures. And you think, well, this fella's, like, stamp should be on this team by now. They don't look like... Do you look at them and go, okay, they're a really well coached team. Like, when you think of United, what do you think their strengths are? Like, they're really good at, like, at Palace. Like, when Palace played them a couple of weeks ago, Palace were just really well organized, kept like a couple of banks of four and kept it really narrow, and then countered as quick as they could. And United had no response at all. They were deservedly beaten and well beaten. Brighton, I don't know how Brighton didn't win the game by 3 or 4 goals. And Solskjaer's, like, comments afterwards, you know, we got away with one. Like, they're not getting away with one. We can all see what's happening. And surely Ed Woodward and all the people who are running Man United or who are making the decisions on the manager's future are seeing this too. So, yes, they should have made signings. Yes, a load of the players yesterday gave the kind of performances that just aren't acceptable. But if you're looking to the dugout, like, if you're looking at a fella whose job, through no fault of his own, his job now is to rally a dressing room or to deal with a hostile... media or an impotent, like, recruitment policy, lots of challenges. You're living in a COVID world, lots of challenges. You're looking at him going, is he the guy? Do you think you're in the right hands here? Did you look at him yesterday in the dugout and go, don't worry, we'll get to halftime and Solskjaer will have something to say. He'll know what to do here. Or when they get in the team meeting tomorrow, okay, they didn't, so they're all on international duty, but, you know, he's... We're in the right hands here. Like, you can't, like those days are gone. Like, whatever emotional argument that you might have had in day one saying, oh, he knows the club, he's been a manager, blah, blah, blah. Like, they're gone. They're outdated arguments at this stage. You look at him now and go, does he fit what this role requires? The answer's no.
But what's changed then in the last few weeks? Because if you look at what had happened to Manchester United so far in 2020, they have now lost as many games in the first 3 matches of this season as they had in the previous 17, I think, of last. Like, in order to get to the point at which they lost 2 matches, if you count back all the Premier League games they played last season, I think you've got to go all the way back to January when they lost to Liverpool. I think that's when you get up to 2 defeats in the previous 17, and they've lost 2 in 3. So what I mean is that I hear what you're saying about Solskjaer. However, he had been in charge of a team which was going quite well. They were defending well. They'd started to figure out ways to score goals quite consistently. And nobody had beaten them between January and Crystal Palace. You know what I mean? So at what point... Okay, I know a lot of those months, there were no matches played. But, like, there's a long unbeaten run there. There's lots of encouraging signs. And now they begin a season where they have had no preseason preparation, really. You see bizarre results all over the place. You know, loads of teams have had blowout defeats. I'm talking here not just about Liverpool and Man City, but also, you know, Bayern Munich, for instance. Bayern Munich got destroyed by, like, Hoffenheim. And sort of, is there no, why do we turn around to Solskjaer and say, this isn't good enough, Ollie? Whereas, you know, when we turn around to Klopp and Guardiola and Hansi Flick or whatever, it's like, well, you know, we know you're good and we can let you off.
A couple of things. Well, first of all, Solskjaer doesn't belong in the same category as Flick or Klopp for loads of obvious reasons. But there is one point that Neville made yesterday which I thought was interesting, and I wouldn't dismiss it entirely. He was mentioning the possible psychological impact on the squad of the club not strengthening the squad over the break. So you just think, okay, we've done really, really well to finish as high as we did last season in third. Now a couple of astute signings, a little bit of strengthening, and we'll push on. And then the lack of those signings has had an impact on the squad, and they're just deflated. Their body language, their mentality, everything. So the board is creating a set of circumstances which is making life more difficult for the players. And I remember having an exact experience about 20 years ago. We finished fourth in the championship. We lost out in the playoffs. Birmingham went up instead of us. And so we spent the summer kind of licking our wounds a little bit, but thinking, Jesus, how close are we to getting into the Premier League? Like a last minute goal in the playoff semi-final and blah, blah, blah. So Birmingham got promoted. Their opening game was away against Arsenal. we stayed in the championship. Our opening game was home against Rotherham, right? Worlds apart. And like, I was fighting my own battles. I did a hip operation at this point, but we lost that game. And there was additional, the day before, there was disputes with the chairman over bonuses. So the preparation wasn't great. But we lost the game 6-0, maybe 6-1. And it was at home. Exact same as yesterday. Probably the exact same kind of performance United gave. Like, everyone was all over the shop. I think I came on for about the last 20 or 30 minutes and I missed about two or three, like, sitters. And we had a meeting then the next day. The manager brought everyone in. And it was one of these clear-the-air meetings you read about. And it was basically everyone sitting in the room, manager, trying to kind of facilitate a chat of going, lad, what's going on? If there's anything needs to be said, say it, because this isn't acceptable. Like, we're going to get nowhere if yesterday becomes the new norm. And the theme of the meeting was, the chairman has shafted us. The chairman is too busy about trying to make it, like, the sums add up or make more profit or whatever he's doing. We needed to strengthen over the summer and we didn't. So what chance have we got of replicating what we did last season? So and so it is a real thing, like, obviously, to feel like, you know, we're doing our job but we need others. But the manager's got it. Go on.
If you played that whole scenario forward, what happened then at Millwall? I mean, was everyone pointing fingers at the chairman? Did anyone end up taking responsibility? Because I remember thinking to myself, yesterday after watching a game, like, everyone has got too many other people to point the finger at here. Mm. You know what I mean? Like, Solskjaer can point the finger both up at Woodward and out towards Harry Maguire, Eric Bailly. Okay, I mean, Eric Bailly wouldn't have been there if Solskjaer hadn't sent them out there. True. But, you know, there's players who let him down. There's the board who's let him down. The board have, Woodward, he's hasn't signed any of the players as usual. But, like, you know, all the stuff that you've been saying about Solskjaer and obviously the players, you know, what can he as a chairman do? He's not the guy who makes the tactical decisions. He's not the guy who chooses to foul his own left back as we try to clear.
That was amazing.
Harry Maguire, he would have given away a penalty for that. Yeah. If Shaw had been a Tottenham player. No one's ever seen anything like it. But then the players as well can do what you're talking about in terms of, well, like, you know, they haven't signed any reinforcements for us. Apart from the only player who has been replaced there, I think, is Martial, who was the guy who got sent off. They've signed Cavani. Once again, they've signed a guy to replace Anthony Martial from PSG on twice his money, which must be really annoying after a good season. But what I mean is, if, like, who's the response going to come from here? It seems as though they've got almost a Mexican standoff of blame where everyone's at fault and nobody necessarily has to step forward and take responsibility.
There are, like, it's a target-rich environment. You're right. If you're looking at people to point at, to say, like, there's underperformance here, or you know, these guys are in roles here and they're not producing. Like, to go back, like, the defending for the goal that you talked about, like, if you put Benny Hill music to that, like, it would fit. Like, when you think of, I don't know what level of football that defending kind of belonged, but it was consistent throughout the whole game. And you're right, the players, those individuals being at that level, have some kind of standards here. Like, and if it was mentioned in the commentary several times, it was brilliant, actually. About an hour, 65-70 minutes into it, there was a couple of heavy challenges, or United players were looking frustrated that they were kind of bite back a little bit, and Neville just kind of slapped them down in commentary and went, lads, you're about 55 minutes too late. There's no good fighting now. So it was all, he was calling them out in the bullshit of the little performative little kind of, you know, like, lashing out in kicks here or there. So you're right, players all, there's a big problem, but I'm going to keep, and obviously Edward, big problem, but at some point, like, to go back to the example I used from 20 years ago, like, it's the manner, if there is an issue within the dressing room, which there clearly is, that brings those group of players of that level to give those kind of performances, this is the manager's domain. Like, Ed Woodward shouldn't be near the dressing room. The media, the fans don't get near the dressing room. It's the manager's domain to take charge completely of it. And I don't get the sense at all that Solskjaer, because he's no track record of doing this at this level at all, So whereas you could say earlier, like, you know, Klopp and Flick, maybe give them a break. You can, because they have a huge body of work behind them to go, well, these guys have been here before and they've produced. Solskjaer doesn't have that. You're still waiting for him to produce something that justifies that he's in the job. So, yes, they can all point the finger and blame one another, but, like, a manager, like, can't be taken seriously in the role that he's in if those performances continue.
A target-rich environment is very good. Very good description. Thanks, Richie. That was great.
Cheers, lads.
Supreme talent. He launched himself 6 feet into the crowd and kung fu kicked a supporter.
There is one more theme from the two big results over the weekend. It's just we're dwelling on for a second, and that is the absence in the Tottenham Hotspur team of Matt Doherty.
Oh, yeah.
With Serge Aurier excelling and scoring a great goal. And in the Aston Villa team, the absence of Conor Hourihan. And in his place, Ross Barkley scoring a goal and just being absolutely everywhere and linking up with Jack Grealish in particular quite well. So yeah. And also Seamus Coleman's hamstring injury forever. Yeah. So things are... there's been a little bit of a bump over the last 24 hours with regards to the Ireland situation.
Yeah, I mean, we did have the two warring right backs, and now we've only got one substitute right back and one injured right back. That's where we're at. I mean, there were a couple of call ups. Cyrus Christie was called, so we've had to call up a new right back, and also Kevin Long was called up to cover for Darragh Lenihan, who got injured and had to pull out of the squad.
I have to read this tweet before we go. I know we've talked a lot already, but it's Michael Friel, another Villa fan, is on. He says, I know I should be asking you to talk up Villa's performance rather than Liverpool's deficiencies on the podcast. Liverpool's behaviour. Right. But even I, says this Aston Villa fan, can acknowledge that Arsenal sacking Gunnar Soros is the bigger story today. Oh, yeah.
Cutbacks.
Yep. The man behind Arsenal mascot Gunnar Soros has been let go by the club as part of their coronavirus cost-cutting process, according to The Athletic. This guy's been dressed up as the friendly green dinosaur at home matches since 1993.
Oh my God. I didn't realise he'd the same guy
same
been doing
guy.
Since 93.
Jerry Key, Q-U-Y. I'm not sure I'd
Q-U-Y.
Q-U-Y, yeah, he's been doing it for that long. That's
Key?
I mean, the mention of Gunnar Soros normally makes people happy, but the fact that this guy is losing his job is actually... more of a downbeat way to end this. Maybe I shouldn't have gone there at all.
Yeah. 27 years service. Oof. That's amazing. It's like he's been going to service for as long as Alex Ferguson was at Man United.
This guy even missed his brother's wedding to dress up as the iconic Gunnar Soros at an Arsenal home match.
Well, that's the way, isn't it? They treat you like a piece of meat, you know, at the end of the day, just a dinosaur steak. I mean, it's not funny, Owen. But I suppose the problem for Gunnar Soros was that with there being no supporters, there's nobody for him to cheer up and sort of cavort.
Arsene Wenger always seemed to perk up, though, whenever he saw Gunnar Soros. So maybe if Mikel Arteta had shown a similar dedication to the cause, Gunnar Soros would still have a job today.
Yeah, maybe. But listen, best of luck to Gunnar Soros on whatever he does.
Whatever comes next, his next step.
Thanks very much, Murph. Thanks, Ken.
Thanks, Owen,
and thank you, Ciarán.
Deep breath after that weekend's football. We'll talk to you again in the World Service tomorrow. Thanks, guys.
What phone is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
It is not war and death and famine. It's not that at all. It's the opposite of that. It's to persuade that there's a world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Thank you.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com. Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's UnitedHealthcare insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.